order, please. Alright, we have, I believe we have one person off in the public comment period for the afternoon. Is that correct? Mark Goudier from UCA.
Hello, board members and chairman. I first will apologize for the shorts. I'm coming from the other side of the mountain where it's been about 90 to 107 for 8 weeks, and I don't even know where my pants are at, so I don't take my chicken legs as any disrespect. Just really quick, a couple things. On the cultural resources conversation, I just want to make a couple quick comments. One of the issues we've been having is a lack of a phone line, and so I don't know if this is the body that can help us with this, but I just wanted to raise that concern. A number of our tribal representatives are really interested in this conversation right now because of where it's going and evolution, and they've requested of me to try my best as their representative to ensure we get a phone line set up. So especially with having this facilitated process, it would be just very advantageous, and I've actually heard it from a number of folks on the west side as well, just the travel time, and it's a fairly short meeting, and a lot of our archaeologists want to be involved in the conversation, and they just don't have the travel funds and the ability to make it to these meetings. So if there's anything you guys could do to help us ensure that we get a phone line set up, especially for this next 6 months, it would be extremely appreciated.
So Mark, that's an administrative thing that will be, DNR will be happy to facilitate. I was unaware of that request.
No problem. No, and this is the first time we've really, it's just been more an ask of my tribal representatives of me to help them with, and so I'm bringing that to you. And I also do want to echo that it is very appreciated having Stephen join us at these meetings. And the level of interest and the movement that we're getting, at least from my tribe's people, are encouraged and appreciative of that. So hopefully over this next 6 months we can make some progress, and it's feeling like we're starting to get on a better path. I do hope, I guess just to close that one, Jeff, right now Jeffrey is kind of the main tribal representative, you know, as the chair, as co-chair. The tribal member who is been the most actively participating, and I just really hope that we continue, this board continues to reach out to Jeffrey to get a good pulse on where the tribe's perspectives are on these issues, as somebody that is really paying close attention to it from a tribal perspective, and I just want to ask that the board is making sure that they're communicating with Jeffrey as best as they can to hear that perspective. And I know he's here now, so I was happy to see that. I was just a little concerned this morning when we moved into the subject without Jeffrey being here, and I know we were ahead of schedule and everything. So hopefully, if there's a need to speak with him, we'll allow that to happen. Moving on, I just wanted to ask on, this is switching gears, but the letter from the feds that was delivered to Mr. Goldmark, and that I think most of the group has seen. There is concerns out there with, I guess, just the pace that we're moving through the Type F issue. And I understand, I guess, why we're at that pace, but in the meantime, A, we're having the drought year and there's concerns there. But then also, just what we've learned and what we understand about water typing as it currently stands, I guess we would just echo the Fed's concerns about having the water type determinations that are made right now where we're finalizing this permanent rule, whether or not they should be permanent on the water type layer, and if they should be considered only temporary until we resolve this. And so one of the things, I'm trying to get a pulse for my region, how many downgrades are happening this year while we're in this drought. I haven't been able to get that information yet, but I'm going to continue to do that. But if there's any way that the DNR could share with all of us how many downgrades have occurred so we can all wrap our heads around what might be potentially occurring out there on the landscape. I think that would help inform all of us to make a good decision on this. That might be one step. But I just wanted to advocate on behalf of the UCUT tribes that it makes sense from our perspective that while we finalize the Type F work, that we do make these water type changes only temporary. So I just wanted to share that. And then the final thing I wanted to just comment on was the compliance monitoring. And I appreciated the fact that DNR was going after those additional funds. We've had some concerns about the change in the compliance monitoring program and the sample size. And one of the things that we've been told from the DNR was, you know, don't worry too much because we're going after these additional funds and we're going to bolster compliance monitoring and we're going to have these new positions. And since those aren't funded, that just elevates our concerns with where the compliance monitoring program is because we don't have that backup now. So I guess just a recommendation would be one of our main concerns is that reduction in sample size and how statistically valid it is. For example, in the Northeast region, we only looked at about 6 FPAs this year, and then we used to look at 30. And then before that, we looked at 30, and we looked at all the different components of each FPA. So if there was an A wetland, a B wetland, an N string, we looked at one of each of those things. Then that was reduced to only looking at one item per FPA, and we have 30, and now we're only looking at one item per FPA and had 6. And it's resulting in 100%. Last year we had 100% compliance rate, and before that we were in the 70% range. So we I guess, have questions about that and have never had a presentation that accurately describes the statistical validity and how we can all be confident that it's reliable and accurate. So I guess the suggestion would be, you know, maybe for this body to have a presentation, and I've requested at the Compliance Monitoring Stakeholders Committee that we get a presentation from DNR, from the statistician, to help us understand. We haven't been able to do that, so it might benefit the whole program to have that presentation, but that's something that we want to share our concerns with, and hopefully we can address moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair is going to use its prerogative if there's no objection. Jeffrey did arrive late today, and I wanted to offer Jeffrey an opportunity to add to the Cultural Resource Annual Report if he has anything that he would like to add to what Karen has already shared with us.
It is a very positive and resounding yes, I would like to. And thank you for the invitation. I do apologize for not being here and being able to present with my co-chair. I never expected you guys to just work as fast as you have. Of course, I've got to make my way down from Tacoma. But I thought I'd just make sure you know I'm trying to stay on top of all the stuff that's going on within our committee. And that's really a mission, a personal mission I took on, at least as of July of 1994. And so I'm now in my 21st year as co-chair of the Cultural Resources Roundtable, formerly Cultural Resources Committee. So just so you're sure, I'm Jeffrey Thomas, the cultural resources contact for forest practices at the Puyallup Tribe. As well as the director of their timber, fish, and wildlife program, and as I say, longtime co-chair of the Cultural Resources Roundtable. I do appreciate the chance to say a few things about the work that we're all involved in together, and in many ways was precipitated by some dilemmas that came to everybody's attention just over a year ago, actually almost 2 years now. That would be at the end of 2013, and of course we're getting close to the end of 2015. By the November meeting, we'll pretty much be at a two-year mark since some of these important issues came to the roundtable's attention. And so I did want to just say a little bit about what you had seen as the, the list of items that were featured, that were, referenced there within the annual report that we had submitted. And it's, certainly respect the items that are there. I wanted to maybe offer a few views about them. I'm just sort of poking here, making sure I've got the right document with me. So what I wanted to try to do was just offer you something that was constructive, cogent, straightforward, maybe policy and rule oriented as well. So here's my copy of 222.20.120, which is the main rule that I'm sure that you're all familiar with. And I thought that maybe it might help for me to just say a few things about the items that are on the list and how that might relate back to the 222.20.120 rule that is in existence right now, especially because it's the descriptions of the issue that, our group's been working with for the last year and a half, maybe not as successfully as we wanted to, has been variously described as Department of Natural Resources FPA conditioning. Yet at the same time, seems to have also been referred to as WAC 222.20.120 interpretations. And so I just wanted to sort of maybe make that the distinction, because they're not necessarily the same thing. And so you can see there in your 222.20.120 language that certainly FPA conditioning is an element of the process associated with identifying cultural resources and then responding on behalf of both the state agency and ensuring that tribal responses are respected as well. And so, you know, just sort of in looking at the list that you have there, then I wanted to say a couple of things about the way that does work or would seem to work or might conceivably need to work later. And so, you know, let's just sort of think about this 222.20.120 rule just real quickly, because it says there in item one that you're going to be able to, you know, I'm going to paraphrase just real quick because I'm sure that we'll need the extra time, but it talks about applications that may contain cultural resources. That's item one. Then right below it under item two is where an application contains cultural resources. I hope you guys appreciate the mysterious nature of moving from one to two. In one, you have an application may, and two, they contain. How do you go from one to two? It's a real important question, because that's basically what's happening with every FPA. They're somehow being screened, identification of cultural resources occurring, evaluation then taking place, inventory being undertaken as needed, and then appropriate protection resulting as well. We'd like to think that identification is pre-app or pre-project at very best, especially in an advanced planning mode, not FPA, not site by site, not wait till the last minute, and then all of a sudden everybody get up in arms. So is there really a landscape advanced planning approach that's available, or is there any kind of commitment, or is it recognized as being somehow an important feature of the system that we're all supposed to be working with together? You know, it's just a sort of a rhetorical question, but I just want to put it out there. And so, you know, what is this idea that we're going to have an FPA that may contain, and now all of a sudden it does contain? And what all goes along with that? And what if it's not implicit within the rule how any of those things are then supposed to mix and match? What happens then? Do you, like, maybe turn to the Forest Practices Board manual to seek additional guidance, since it is the technical advisory supplement document for the Forest Practices Rules? That's a place to go, but you won't find anything. Would you go to the Forest Practices Application Instructions document and see what you do to answer the question, the one single question that's there, which just basically says, if you're in the mood, contact the tribe, so you can double check. You know, there's a list of items. There are physiographic items, such as, talus slopes, proximity to shorelines, that kind of thing. They're identified as, they're very specifically identified as being, environmental features that a landowner is encouraged to look for because they may have an association with cultural resources. But there's nothing in the instructions that says, and as such, indicated somewhere on the FPA or even on the map. So even if they are there, what good does it do a tribe, because they're always just going to be like in the dark, presuming that there is, or maybe mistakenly presuming that there isn't. So what good are all these things when it comes to identification, sort of the point, and do we really have the right kind of process that we need in order to back them up? And, you know, when we're talking about the concern to the Yakima tribe, which is that the FPA conditioning itself is not being established, set forth, made directly obvious as a feature of approving the FPA, and in their experience, that had been done before. They thought that was a problem, and that was sort of the gist of the problem that we're trying to resolve in our group now. So again, what is in the rule? What does it really do when it comes to being able to move from very important point A to the all-important point Z when it comes to cultural resource protection and management work? Now, those are kind of the questions that I have in my mind, so I just thought I'd try to share them with you today. And so let's just stick with that list real quick, you know, and I'll just sort of point out a couple of things and I'll go away. And so here's a couple of things I want to point out. I want to point out that they're on the beginning of the list, and I'll just go to what would be like maybe page 4 of the document you were given as the annual report. And so we just sort of say, okay, so you know, where do these things start to fit in, or do they? When it comes to the rule, and what if they're not and don't have an association with the rule, does that mean that they're unimportant to the board? That's sort of a question I have, because I'm not sure. And so let's just sort of look at maybe the first six and just say, yeah, those pretty much have a good connection to the rule. You know, so you've got, the first one, change may to shall, well, that's down there in number 4. But these other ones consistently require a meeting, that's sort of implicit there within number 2. In certain incidental discovery language, again, maybe that's somehow implicit under number 4 as a condition. Use a predictive model to screen every FPA. I guess that's somewhere, maybe a concept that you would associate with 2, again, getting from 1 to 2, and where the agency itself might fit. And then the discovery of cultural sites, you know, inventory, evaluate, preserve, protect, that kind of stuff, you know, again, would seem under 2, maybe 3, is just sort of the results of the work. Then the next one, assure tribal access. You know, to tribally significant areas through binding consultation. I don't know how that's really going to tie into the rule. You know, the way it's worded right now, because right now it's not access and you know its purposes and that sort of thing. Or again, maybe at best implicit within number 2. So, also as long as I'm saying access, I might as well say, that's not just referenced twice within the Timber Fish and Wildlife Agreement, both in the introductory portion, where the goals themselves are presented, but of course also there within the section called Archaeological and Cultural Resources that itself is described as being a new component, a component of the new management system. And in there it says archaeological cultural resources, by definition, are as they describe. There's an archaeological and there's a cultural. You know, cultural aren't necessarily historic. In fact, they're modern day ongoing activities. And it says that those activities that haven't been practiced for some time may be reestablished, especially if they were due to access problems or site conditions. So we've mentioned access problems here, but we haven't mentioned site conditions. So isn't that the whole idea of reviewing an FPA, at least under the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Agreement, that in fact the tribe would comment on site conditions and be in some sort of position to respond to current, let alone preferred site condition concepts? So, you know, I don't see the FPA or the tribal comments or even the rule really being set up for that yet, these site condition evaluations and let alone responses or expectations of the tribes. So I feel like we're a little bit outside the box.
So Jeffrey, can you summarize?
Summarize, yep. So my summary, you know, now that I've sort of said, there is stuff here that's specific to your rule that is on our list, but there's a bunch of other stuff here that sort of starts to, you know, maybe touch on other places. So you've got, you know, things like, others are saying, you know, this might go along with the Forest Practices Board manual, such as, you know, let's develop additional tools for the tribes, or, you know, what about, you know, clarifying existing authority? You know, that's a little, again, not really rule related. You know, these surveys, and what they consist of, you know, those are a big concern to me, because I don't know that anybody in our group actually has experience in designing, let alone conducting, let alone analyzing a survey that's, really scientifically valid. And so I fear that that's something we're a charge you're expecting of us that we just not really don't have that we're just not qualified to do. In terms of, yeah, I have a lot of ideas of what would be in that survey. I would like to go right to the Crump and say it needs to reflect the Crump itself and all of the obligations there, not just be something that's sort of a gap filler. So I'm very keen on what is going to be the particulars of that specific work. Same thing with cross-training opportunities. I really think that unless your tribal cultural resources contact for forest practices has actually endorsed what's going to be delivered to stakeholders within its area, it's plain old missing the mark. And then the biannual review, you know, we talk about here as being biannual, but then in the prompt it says biannual, so, you know, I know it's 6 months or 2 years aren't exactly the same period of time. So, again, those are just things that I know we're all trying to tee up. Then finally, let me say cultural resources and public resources, if they do have public resource elements, I've been saying for a long time I think they do. We really need a strategy for moving forward that kind of legislation. Maybe lastly, just to mention legislation, let me please refer to RCW 90.71.300, which is the enabling legislation for the Puget Sound Partnership, which the Puyallup Tribe considers to be a management area that overlaps with that of its timber fishery wildlife program. In that, it specifies that the work in Puget Sound is supposed to highlight, on behalf of Puget Sound Partnership and Restoration of Puget Sound, is supposed to highlight both ecosystem management as well as quality of life, which they translate there as human well-being, and have just now rolled out the human well-being indicators that they expect to use for their work. I would say we don't have counterparts and that we should. There were basically 7609 is in conflict with the more recent provisions of 90.71.300. So with that, I guess I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Next agenda item, please. Barred owl control measures update and species review process, both by federal agencies and state. So I have both Robin Brown and Penny Baker up, please. Going to go first, Penny, or is...
Yes, I think I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Penny Becker. I'm the Acting Wildlife Diversity Division Manager at WDFW, and I was asked to talk about our state periodic status review process, of which northern spotted owl and several other forest species are undergoing currently. So I've prepared a general understanding of how we operate in the state in our status reviews. So currently we have 46 state listed species, of which there are sensitive, threatened, and endangered species. We use guidance from WAC 232-12-297 to guide what needs to happen as far as reviewing the status of those species over time. The three different ways that we can look at any potential changes in classification recommendations are either an uplisting, so taking something from a sensitive, if the population is looking like it's crashing, if there's more threats acting on it, we may go to an endangered or a threatened status, so an upshift. A downlisting, so if something was endangered and it's starting to do better, it might get to threatened, sensitive, or it could be delisted altogether. Or a no change in status. So since the species was listed, we really haven't seen a change, and therefore it should maintain the same protection. Other than DFW initiating it every 5 years, we also have a process within that PAC that if we receive a petition to look at the status of any of those species, that we have to look at that petition and see if there's scientific data that's been set forth that may show that it's either failing, declining, or improving over time. And that petition must go to the director. And after 60 days, the agency has to respond to that petition saying, yes, we will start performing a periodic status review and putting all that information together, or that petition would be declined. We're working on a streamlined status review process, as you might imagine, having 46 species constantly under review every 5 years is a really big task. So our focus really is on not rewriting all of the natural history and general information on those species every time, but really focusing on all that information that's happened since the last time the species were reviewed on how it's doing today. So looking at the threats acting on it, what are the recovery actions that are currently ongoing, and how is the species reacting to those conservation actions. The first step in the process really is to allow the public to send in any information that could be put into our periodic status review. And so that's a one-year process. We put that out and say, here's all the species that are coming in the next year, and we're looking for this type of information. So everything from, you know, studies that researchers might have done that they think DFW might not have, to any companies or consultants who may have information that might be helpful to us, or any general public that have sightings of species saying, hey, we really think the distribution might have changed because I've got this in my backyard. So those are all things that DFW can follow up on. So here's the first batch of periodic status reviews. We decided we wanted to really get the 46 species done within the next 3 years. So this first batch was put out in February of last year, in 2014. So February 2015 was when the comment period ended for public to put input in. So now what we're doing is for all of these species, we're doing the literature review process, putting all the public information together into a status review for all of those species. Here's a list of the species that are ongoing and their status. So the second batch opened up for public input in February and will be open until next February, and then we have another batch that will be following that. So keeping us very busy. We've developed a website with our public affairs so that it's very easy for people to submit their information. There's just a little button on the right there where you submit comments, and it links you directly to this site that is a form that people can go ahead and fill out their information so that we can follow up with them and any info that they have to contribute, including attaching any pertinent documents. So if we were to get a information in a periodic status review that said, you know, a species really requires more protection, or we're not really making a whole lot of progress on this species, what would be our reaction to that? Really, it would be, we need to double down and do more conservation for those species so that we can down and delist them over time and they don't require those protections. And that can require a whole lot of things for us to do following the periodic status review. So we could initiate or expedite additional conservation actions. So everything from predator control to augmenting a population by translocations from other places, additional outreach to stakeholders, partnerships, habitat enhancement acquisition. There's the whole long list of things that we can do. Really importantly, certainly focus on pursuing more and expediting landowner incentives and agreements to be able to get that conservation on their own. Another route is to recommend reconsideration of habitat protection measures if we feel like that's a component that is an important threat against that species. We could update the recovery plan, so if we see that there's strategies that are needed for those species that aren't currently included in the recovery plan and aren't part of the recovery strategy, that we could update that and include partners to get working on those actions. And lastly, if there's information that's lacking to really tell us whether a change in status is needed, or we have an inkling that things might be getting better or worse, but we don't have enough data, then that would require extra intensive effort on the monitoring side. If we get to a point where we see that we're recommending a delisting of a species, like we just did recently, I believe it was March, for the Stellar Sea Lion, we delisted that species, so that'll require us to continue monitoring how that species is doing. And 5 years after delisting, we also have to do a review of that species to make sure that any protections that have gone away haven't changed the course of how that species is doing. and really just the common conservation that we do for other species that don't have enormous populations. We want to keep those common species common. So more general landscape actions like habitat conservation for those species. So periodic status reviews are going to be continually ongoing, rotating basis. We currently have the 3-year batch that's set up. There's consistent opportunity for the public to engage both in the upfront to add anything to your periodic status review, and then they're also vetted through a public review process. So several of those species that are in the first batch that I showed you are have already been through public review or about to be in public review, which is 90 days for the public to look at that document and DFW's recommendation on the listing, any listing changes or recommendations to the commission before it's sent to the commission. And then, of course, we have the commission process where we present what we think should happen to all of those species. In particular, I know you're very interested in what's going on with the Northern Spotted Owl periodic status review. That one is in draft now. It's been through the process where we're internally looking at a draft, and we've engaged some outside peer reviewers as well to work on that document. And we're within a week of two of sending that out for the public review process for that 90-day period. So it's moving along nicely. With that, any questions?
Board Member Swedeen.
Thanks for the presentation, Dr. Becker. I am wondering, so with the spotted owl is already endangered, and you're doing a status review, and so it very well could be in that category of, and you can't change the status, right, because there's no category beyond that, but you'll be in the position of considering what additional things need to happen if you find that the status is not improving. If I remember correctly, the owl doesn't have a state recovery plan. Is that true?
Yeah, there's a federal recovery plan.
Right. But given that the federal recovery plan covers a much larger area than the state, and at least the last demographic reviews, I remember populations are declining more quickly in Washington in the northern part of the range than they are in the rest of it. Would you guys as an agency consider doing a state recovery plan as one of the actions, you know, given that, you know, if it's warranted, essentially? And that might be more of a question for you, but it just seems like that's one of the steps that could be taken that, you know, we don't have them.
From my perspective, it's always an option. One thing we want to consider is we only have so much staff time. So do we want that staff time to be used in developing a state plan? Or are there specific actions that we want to call out as actual conservation for those staff to be involved in? Mm-hmm. So it's really a discussion about how we want to use those resources for spotted owls.
Any other questions? Thank you. Okay. Robin, would you like to?
First of all, my name is Robin Bound. I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in our Oregon office. The way the service is set up, the vets, we are the office responsible for oversight on all spotted owl issues, so the local office here takes care of all the Washington-based issues. We sort of try to coordinate between the different states, in this case on the northern spotted owls. So, I'm going to give you a short update on where we are with our status review process and what's been going on, some of it you may be aware of from press reports, and then I'll go on and talk about our barred owl removal experiment. Very good. So as you know, the northern spotted owl is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. In August of 2012, we received a petition to list the northern spotted owl as endangered, or to uplist it from threatened to endangered, from EPIC in California. We did a quick review of the information, came to a determination that an emergency uplisting was not necessary. That's kind of the first step we do in the process. And then in April 2015, we issued the positive 90-day finding. And yes, I know that's not 90 days after the petition. We're under a settlement agreement with the federal courts to deal with some 400 species over the course of 5 years. So we have some discretion to, and just in reality with our staffing, miss some of those dates. However, we did come out with a positive 90-day finding, which means that the information that was presented in that petition warranted more in-depth review, that there was a potential that it might need to be uplisted. We completed a 60-day public comment period on that finding. And then we are now on track to complete the 12-month status review on or before, hopefully before, we're really shooting to get before this, June 30th of 2017. Again, not 12 months, but we are moving forward. If we determine that the petition uplisting to endangered is warranted, we would come out at that time with a proposed uplisting package, uplisting as endangered package, very similar to when we listed it originally. We're also, since this process is looking at all the latest information on spotted owls, we're going to use this as our five-year review for the species also. It's due up about then anyhow. And our five-year review process is very similar to the state process, so I'm not going to take you through a lot of detail on it, but that basically is the same kind of thing. We put out a notice, we pull in information, we take a look at it, and we'll do it as part of this process of evaluating whether we need to update the species. Now, the public comment period has closed. However, I should note that we are always willing to accept information at any time. Earlier is always better, but if anybody has, we always encourage people, if you have any new information about the spotted owl, you have new data or locations or anything that we might not have, they can send it to us at any time. The public comment period is not the end of when we accept information. So, and I think that's about all I have on it, on the update. I should mention that the regulatory consequences of changing something from endangered or threatened to endangered is really minor. The way the law is written, endangered species and threatened species get almost the same protection. Really, the two differences are if you are caught taking the species, it costs you a little bit more if it's an endangered species, and we're not allowed to write a 4D rule for an endangered species. We can for a threatened species. We tried that 20 years ago with the northern spotted owl. I got involved in that. Never really went anywhere, and we're not intending to go anywhere with it now. The state of Washington is covered under the state HCP. There's no need for that. So they're really, even if we do go forward with this, and it's one of the reasons the service doesn't get too excited about going from threatened to endangered, so it really isn't going to change the level of protection. What it does change is the perception of people's part, that this has now gotten worse. And so that in itself is important, and it can be very helpful. Any questions on the status report?
I just had a quick question on that statement you made about the state being covered under an HCP for spotted owls. Mm-hmm. Were you referring to the state lands HCP?
No, I was referring to several of the HCPs that are out there and also the forest and fish rules, I believe, but I'm going to get way out of my experience here real fast and probably make a mistake. When we originally, the original 4D rule that we were working on looks very similar to the SOCI network. In fact, it is the same as the SOCI network. So we think that the state of Washington really covered everything that was needed. We didn't need to go forward with the 40 rule, put it in federal law, and then that's really hard to change if things change later. So I cannot remember, it's been 20 years, whether we actually finished that or whether we just dropped it as the state came in with their proposals.
So I
can look up.
I'm pretty sure that statewide there is no coverage for, the state does not have a permit on private lands through forest practice rules, and it's relevant to our business here that the forest and fish HCP does not include incidental paying for spotted owls, and so it's a policy issue for us because we actually do have a difference between where Section 9 CAPE guidance applies and where our state rules apply.
Okay. So I know I'd get out into something in Washington that I wasn't that experienced with. I know we're going to and you can talk with our folks in our Washington office. It hasn't been much of an issue up here from what I understand. Hasn't been much of an issue in Oregon either. You notice how well we prosecute take cases. That's it.
I will note, and I'm sure more members of the team is aware that there are several landowners, including the state lands, that have multiple species, HCPs that cover owls.
Any other questions on the status review? Move on to the subject I do know a lot more about. The barred owl removal experiment. How many folks here have heard of the Barnell Google experiment. It's been in the paper often enough, I can't imagine anybody's escaped it. Seems to come up about every 3 to 6 months. So I'm going to start with just a little background on, a quick background on the experiment, sort of the why behind the experiment, because it leads to the what we're actually proposing. So if you're really familiar with this, please feel free to snooze. I'm okay with that. But I think it's important that people sort of have an understanding of where we came from. So the spotted owl was listed in 1980, and the primary reason for that listing was the loss of habitat, both historically and ongoing at the time, that both from logging but also from catastrophic events like large wildfires. Starting around 1980, there was a new threat that began to emerge that was competition from the newly arrived barred owl. Now, the barred owl is an eastern forest species. It's represented by blue on this map here. Historically, they were found east of the Mississippi River in the forests in the east, and you'll notice not even very far up into Canada. The spotted owl, on the other hand, is our West Coast species. And these two species, they're represented, in red on here. These two species have been separated, my geneticist friends tell me, for well over a million years, probably several million years. And that separation was probably due to the relatively treeless Great Plains, because this is a forest owl, and the fact that the boreal forest, which does occur north of the Great Plains across Canada, is a fairly harsh conditions, low food supply, and we think that they simply couldn't survive up there, or they would have been there. They couldn't survive on the resources. The area that they had to breach to make it to the West Coast is so large, it's not something a single owl is going to pick up and move across the Great Plains or across the boreal forest. So you're talking about a multi-generational movement where they've got to stop, breed, produce more young, and move on. Around 1900, barred owls did start to expand. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of data from that period, so we don't know exactly how they got across that area, and we don't know exactly why. There's a lot of good theories out there, almost all of which involve some sort of human manipulation of those two conditions, the plains and the boreal forest. They reached the northwest, British Columbia, around the 1950s, and in 1959, the first one was reported within the range of the northern spotted owl. By 1973, there was a location in Washington, because once they got out to the West Coast, they began to spread both north and south along those big forests of the Cascades and Coast Ranges. So 1973 in Washington, 1974 we had one identified in Oregon, and 1976 in California. So you know that there's some individuals that are making some pretty big movements here. Most of these were literally that. They were individuals, and for many years, for a couple decades, we had one here, one there. There weren't a lot of them. However, at that same time, they were beginning to grow in population, starting in the north where they first invaded, and behind these prospecting individuals and spreading south. We now have breeding barred owls as far south as Marin County, so all the way through the entire range of the northern spotted owl, and down into the southern Sierras as individuals. So they have not completed their movement yet. As early as the 1980s, researcher Tom Hamer was observing barred owls moving in along the rivers in northern Washington, the Mount Baker area, and displacing spotted owls out of territories where he'd been studying them. Now, biologists initially speculated that barred owls, which are known to prefer kind of low gradient and wet sites if they get the option, would move in along the rivers and they would displace the spotted owls there, but the spotted owls would survive and reproduce in the uplands and everything would be okay. Nobody told the barred owl. As soon as they filled up the preferred lower gradient habitat, they began to move up into the upslopes. In fact, we have not found anywhere within the range of the northern spotted owl any habitat that spotted owls can use that barred owls don't also prefer. And in fact, the latest studies show that they have the same preference given the choice, those bigger, multi-storied, diverse kinds of forests. As time progressed, we began to note some big changes in populations of spotted owls, changes beyond what we expected as part of what was going on prior to listing. So we knew that they were declining at, you know, 2-2.5% rate per year in the early years of listing, and we had actually started to see that start to mellow out, and then we began to see some steeper declines coming back. And the most, probably the most dramatic of this was in our Cleland study area, which is in northern Washington. We started our spotted owl surveys up there, our spotted owl studies back just before the 1990s, and you can see by the time we started it, we were probably already into our decline phase. In the 22 years that I represent on this chart, we have lost 85% of the population in the Cleland study area. We're down to a few individuals and maybe one or two pairs, and almost no breeding in most years. Now, you go down in Oregon, where we were a little bit further behind in the invasion. The invasion didn't really get started too much until about 1997. But in 1997, we began to see spotted owls in our Central Oregon Coast Ranges decline. And in just 15 years, they've declined about 73%. And even in Southern Oregon, where I used to work, it took a lot longer for the barred owls to get established. It's climate province type country. But once they did, the populations have started declining. In the last 10 years, from, well, 2002 to 2012, we've lost 45% of our population there. And we're seeing these same kind of results as you move south through the range, just offset by a few years. So the first question people asked us was, well, why is the spotted owl declining? And why is it declining so precipitously? Especially since some of these areas didn't have a lot of timber harvest going on. There weren't a lot of big fires in there during that period. Well, the only or the best correlation we have to events that are going on out there was the invading barred owl, the invasion of the barred owl, and the increase in their populations, probably exacerbated by continuing loss of some habitat, some big fires occurred in some excuse me, some areas, and also affects the early effects of climate change. This same pattern that you see here is occurring across all of our study areas. This one just sort of demonstrates it the strongest. It's one of our bigger study areas. We have more data to work with. This is the red line shows the number of spotted owl sites that are surveyed as part of these ongoing demography studies, where at least one barred owl has responded. And these are responding to spotted owl surveys, so these aren't ones they're going out and looking for. We know we're missing a bunch. And the blue line at the top represents the number of those sites that were occupied by spotted owls. What we generally see in these areas is that for a few years we have just a few sites that have barred owls associated with them, and that may be only one barred owl. And then they get to about 20% of the sites being occupied. It's interesting, this shows up on almost all these charts. Around that area somewhere, we start to see spotted owl populations or spotted owl occupancy begin to drop off like this. And this chart doesn't really represent barred owl populations, it just represents sites that are occupied. The fact that a site's occupied could be there with one barred owl on it, it could be there could be as many as six. These guys have a smaller home range than spotted owls, and as a result, we have some sites where a spotted owl site now has three or four pair of barred owls on it. So think multi-competition. All right, so in the 2008 recovery plan and also our 2011 revised recovery plan, the barred owl was identified now as one of the two primary threats to the northern spotted owl. So this changed in about 23 years, our understanding of the species. Not that we weren't aware of it at the time we listed the spotted owl, but it really hadn't shown up as a potential really large threat at that point. To address this threat, there are actually 10 recovery actions in the recovery plans. One of those recovery actions is recovery action 29. Which was to design and implement a large-scale experiment to allow us to look at the effects of removing barred owls on spotted owls. And that's what we're doing. In September 2013, we signed a record of decision after a five-year process with an exhaustive and extensive EIS and a lot of public outreach. And what we decided to do to implement this experiment was to do a demography study on four study areas. These study areas are distributed north to south throughout the range of the spotted owl. This allows us to look at different kinds of habitat, different lengths of time that barred owls have been in high populations in these areas, and also some differences in the major food supply. We're using a combination of lethal and non-lethal removal methods, although for reasons I can explain to people at the break if they want, we do anticipate most of the removal will be lethal removal. Yes, that does mean shooting them. I don't want to use too many, nice sounding words for what we're doing. And we estimated it will take about 4 years of removal to get to statistically significant results. That's based on what we know about the species from previous studies. We do have the ability to go another year or two if we need to, if it isn't quite panning out to be as strong a data as we expect. Whoa. Okay, don't get this far. So the way we do the study, it's a classic control treatment study, something we don't get to do very often in wildlife, so it's kind of exciting in that respect. We're doing a demography study, meaning we're tracking individual spotted owls because it gives us the strongest data. We'll divide the study area into two pieces. We'll survey barred owls and spotted owls across the entire study area. Then on half the area, what's called the treatment area, we're going to remove the barred owls. The other half, we leave them alone and track what happens to the spotted owl populations on both. If barred owls are one of the primary impacts on spotted owls in these cases, and if removal will reduce that impact, allow the spotted owls to recover somewhat, we would expect to see the spotted owl populations on the treatment area do better than those on the control area. We initiated the study on the Hoopa Reservation in Northern California in the fall of 2013, right after we signed our record of decision. We were able to do that because the Hoopa tribe has actually been interested in this for many years, and they had been doing barred owl surveys for several years, so they had the necessary pre-treatment data to do this. Their first year, they removed 71 barred owls, and this is a fairly small, it's the smallest of our study areas. It is nice sometimes starting one study area ahead of the others. We learned a lot. They did end up leaving 12 barred owls out there that they weren't able to get the first year. They completed their spotted owl surveys during the spring and summer of 2014, as well as some barred owl surveys there at the same time. Then this last fall and winter, they removed 54 barred owls, including those 12 they had left there previously. And they're in the process of finishing up their spotted owl surveys this year. We're hoping to look at our initial analysis, or we do an initial analysis of the data this fall. It's only 2 years. It's still, there's a lot of variation in these things, so we don't expect to get super strong results, but we're going to take our first look to see if we're seeing anything that we can pick out of the data. There does seem to be some improvement in the spotted owls, but you never want to just use straight numbers to look at the stats. We are initiating the study on the remaining three study areas now. We started barred owl surveys this spring on all three of the study areas. We will be initiating removal on the Plea Ellum and Coast Range study areas in the fall of this year, fall of 2015. And we will initiate removal on the Union Myrtle Klamath, which is down in Southern Oregon, in the fall of 2016. This is probably the one you're most interested in. This is the Plea Ellum study area. The area outlined in blue there, this is part of an ongoing spotted owl demography area that has been going on, where the data came from for those charts I was showing you. The area in blue is the control area where we will be surveying but not removing any barred owls, and the area in red is the treatment area. In this case, because of the nature of the setup of the area, we had to sort of use two treatment areas. Statistically, doesn't make any difference. We have received permission for access for barred owl surveys across this entire study area on most of the primary landowners. And we're in the process of finishing up with the primary non-federal landowner, which is the Nature Conservancy now, in our treatment area. They're at the last, they're a large organization. Like any large organization, there's a process. And they were literally on the phone at 11 this morning at the tail end of the process of giving us permission to do the removal. So we do have a little bit of data for you, because we are doing this barred owl surveys this year, just to give you an idea. The surveys are done on a grid, a hexagonal grid, looks like a honeycomb, that's spread across the entire study area. And they survey and we record the actual locations of the birds that they hear, but also just whether or not that particular polygon, that particular hexagon is occupied. So on the Clay Elm study area, which is fairly dry condition and there's a lot of non-habitat within these, they've still found at least one barred owl in 68% of those survey units, and have identified at least 82 territorial pairs to date. And we expect those numbers to go up as they finish up the surveys here in the next month. The Oregon Coast Range is a little further south. They've actually detected barred owls on 81%. And there's at least one location where they have four pair of barred owls that will spawn from a single spot. So the density in the Oregon Coast Range seems to be the highest we have anywhere. And about 189 territorial pairs and counting. Now, you may be aware we were sued over this, our decision to go forward with this experiment. The Friends of Animals filed a lawsuit in October of 2013 in the Northern District of California. We went through that lawsuit, that case, and in July of the following year, the judge ruled in our favor, but it was based on standing, so it's a fairly technical legal issue. The plaintiffs decided to bring a similar version of the lawsuit, refiled it in the District of Oregon in September of 2014, and the judge ruled in our favor again in July of this year. This one was much more to the point. She covered every point that they dealt with, and she came down on our side on all those points. It's a very strong response, and if you like to read legal documents, I'd recommend it. It's kind of free. However, all plaintiffs have the ability to appeal things, and they have decided to appeal. I found out that as of Wednesday of last week, they have appealed the decision to the Ninth Circuit Court. We're fairly confident in, given the strength of the decision we got out of the judge in the district court. There's no like new kind of legal discussion in there. It's all pretty straightforward, and that usually means that it's pretty easy for us to prevail. But we'll see. You can never prejudge court cases. And with that, this is the website where you can find more information. We have a 500-page EIS if you're really needing something to fall asleep with. There are some parts that are really good. And with that, I'll ask for any questions.
Yeah, just a quick question. Is there a stay on your activities while this is under?
No, they have never requested stay on any activities. They didn't request in either of the district court cases. And I asked my lawyers, well, can they do it in the circuit then if they haven't asked? They could ask for it. They haven't seemed to be looking for that. And they would have a very difficult case to make not having asked for a stay of activity in the previous cases. So we don't see any reason why we would not be proceeding as well.
Board Member Sars.
Background question. How long does the study last? You've got to obviously keep removing barn owls for a period of time.
Based on what we know, we think we can get our results that we're looking for, which is, does this work? It's really what we're looking for here. Does this work to improve spotted owl populations? We think we can get that with 4 years of removal, so that makes the whole study about 5 years. You have to do a pre-removal survey, and you have to do a post-removal survey. So the entire study, we anticipate to take 5 years on each study area. In our EIS, however, we did note that that's based on some assumptions, and if the response is not as strong as we anticipate, we may have to go additional years. And we have the ability to do that under our EIS if we need to. We also have the ability to stop at the end of 3 years if the data is strong enough to answer the question. This is an experiment to gather information for the next step of the process, which is the Fish and Wildlife Service will be engaging a wide variety of people in developing a barred owl management strategy, of which removal may or may not be one of the tools we try to use. But we intend to start to move forward in a couple of years with the preliminary discussions about what do we need to do? Are we going to manage barred owls? How could we manage them? And this will be some of the information that will go into it. So this is a study that ends, and when it ends, we anticipate the barred owls will probably reoccupy the area within 3 to 5 years based on what we know right now.
Robin, just to satisfy the scientist in me, assuming that the four areas that were chosen for removal had something to do with the strength of the spotted owl in those areas? I mean, I'm assuming that...
Oh, why did we choose them?
Yeah, why did you choose them? Because I'm assuming that if you chose an area where the spotted owl population had already started to crash, you may not, no matter how much removal you did, you may not see the results you were looking for.
Well, actually, that's one of the results we wanted to find out. In this case, what we were really looking for is information that we could use to extrapolate across the range. So we actually wanted to look at all types of conditions. So for example, the Cleellum study area has pretty well crashed. I think they might have gotten some breeding this year, but they haven't for the last couple years. And one of the questions that we've always had is, did we wait too long in Washington? Are the spotted owls, are there enough out there that they can even respond if we remove? So we actually picked that in part for that reason. We wanted to make sure we had a northern study area where, we're risking that we might not find an easy response, but that's good information for that next step also. And then also, that's the only east side study that we had. We were limited in the end because we decided to do demography studies. We were limited to looking at places where we already have that kind of data being collected. Because it takes about 5 years to get good background data on the demography of spotted owl. So if we wanted to start from scratch, we'd have to take 3 to 5 years before we could even start the removal. So that limited us to about 12 areas across the range of the spotted owl where those studies are going on. And then from that, we wanted to pick an east side site. The only one we had was Cleellum. We wanted to pick a coast range site in Oregon because that's an area that had been really high populations of spotted owls by comparison. We wanted to make sure we covered the Klamath province. And we did that with our other two study areas. And we wanted that distribution of time and density of barred owls that were probably out there. I should note that up in Canada, they've been doing a removal process, not an experiment, but actually removing barred owls. They took a lot of their spotted owls into captivity. They've been trying to raise spotted owls, and they're going to put them back out. And they don't want to put them back out into a spotted barred owl territory. So they've been doing some removal around their historic sites or wherever they find spotted owls. And interestingly, most of the areas that they've been doing that removal, after a couple of years, they've actually had spotted owls show back up, which is pretty amazing. I was really surprised. And last time I talked to them, they said almost all those sites have had at least one response now from the smug owl, so as well. And that's hopeful.
So what you just said piqued my curiosity, and it kind of potentially applies to the results around the clam area. So that suggests what happened in British Columbia is that there are sort of silent floaters in the population that haven't gone away, but we just haven't been able to detect them through typical surveys. So the fact that there's some showing up might suggest in these areas where it looks like the population has crashed, there might actually be a little bit of a floater population that could recolonize.
Yeah, that's the expectation. And one of the principal investigators that's doing the study for us also did his PhD work down in Central Oregon, where they had radio tags on both barred and spotted owls. And he actually observed situations during the 3 years he was studying them where a barred owl moved in, the spotted owl moved out. He was able to find them. They weren't responding anymore, but he was able to find them because they had radios on. And they were basically sitting in small patches that the barred owls were apparently letting them stay in. They weren't reproducing, they weren't breeding. So you have a limited amount of time before you start running out of birds, because if they're not on their territory, they're floaters, they're probably not breeding. But what we saw in Canada makes us hopeful that there's still enough birds left out there that if we do create an area where they don't get hassled by barred owls constantly, and we're not going to be able to move 100% of the barred owls in these areas or keep them out during the period completely. So we're hopeful that we in fact have enough left in Cleo to respond. But that is one of the questions we want to answer, because in the end it might be, if you want barred owls in the Northern Cascades, you may have to not only remove the barred owls, but you may have to augment the population. But that's something we're going to learn now in the next 4 years.
Or matter of store.
Yeah, those are two great presentations. Thank you. We had a committee meeting of the Spotted Owl Committee this last weekend that I thought went pretty well, focusing on safe harbor agreements. And I just, after looking at the modeling, the extensive modeling that's been done up here that supports a lot of that work, and then your comments just now, whatever we can do to accelerate, to invest in, to move those safe harbor agreements forward, so while we're dealing with the spotted owl, we're also dealing with this habitat issue, and any available habitat that we can set aside now or that we expect to be there in 50 years, we ought to be looking for ways to incentivize that, to support the landowners that might provide that, and to move that forward. I think it's going to be key. Our species review this winter, is going to bring that up again, and so I'm just anxious to try to make some progress in those areas.
I think that's a very good idea, because habitat is still key. The less habitat you have, the less likelihood that you're going to be able to keep spotted owls on the landscape, because we know they're not going to be able to use 100% of the barred owls. The service doesn't expect to and doesn't intend to eradicate barred owls in the West. Couldn't do it if we wanted to, and we don't want to. So we're going to be dealing with managing, and that's why we talk about management strategy. And part of that is maintaining habitat for the species, right?
Any other questions? Member Scanlon.
I'm just thinking about, with seeing your map on Leon, do you anticipate skewed results on the control section? Because I think I was a barred owl, I'd get the heck out of the treatment area. That you see an increased population of barreds in control?
Well, the nice thing is we'll be able to detect that, because we are surveying barred owls across the entire range. The evidence we have from the study that was going on Green Diamond Land down in California and our work in the Hoopa is that, like spotted owls, the barred owls, once they establish a territory, they're pretty hardcore about staying on that territory and protecting it. And we're not seeing any evidence that they're moving next door because we're out there. A typical removal involves calling them in, and they're very willing to come in and defend their territory. And two shots, one for each bird. And this is you set it up so that you have a very humane, very quick kill. And so they don't really seem to react much to that. And in fact, the folks who've been doing it long for several years will note that they can take, if they take the male first, because they're the timid ones, yeah. The females are the really aggressive ones. They take the female first, the male may get timid and go off and not come back. But if they take the male first, they can almost always get the female within 5 minutes. So they're really not keying in on this disturbance of this, this short-term disturbance of removal very much, as far as we can tell so far. Yeah, we're going to be, that's the cool thing about this study, is we're going to be able to detect that with these neighboring control areas where we're not removing them. If we start to see those populations increasing faster, it may tell us that there may be some movement.
Any other questions from the board? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Would the policy co-chairs and the adaptive management administrator come back?
Yes.
Lauren. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Lauren. I'm getting all excited.
Good afternoon, Chair Burnett, board members. I'm Lauren Burns, I staff the Northern Spot Owl implementation team. Board Member Storer just mentioned, the implementation team met last Friday to discuss scope and structure of the programmatic safe harbor agreement. And just for the sake of the public and the board members, programmatic safe harbor agreement, completely voluntary, opt-in option for landowners to get out of circle-by-circle management and get more of a landscape-based approach. So in review, having completed the NSOIT technical team population response modeling work that was presented to the board last February, DNR was able to make some staff resources available toward furthering the development of the voluntary safe harbor agreement per NSOIT recommendations for the Board Practices Board. The implementation team took the opportunity to meet with and discuss priority for this project with Eric Rickerson, who's the new state director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Fish and Wildlife Service has also assigned a staff person, Mark Ostwell, to provide technical assistance to DNR and the NSOIT in the development of the safe harbor agreement. Board members Sweeney and Storer continue to be directly involved in this process, which DNR very much appreciates. And the NSYT is beginning to address key high-level policy choices that need to be made in drafting the safe harbor agreement. During the August 7th discussion, these included mechanisms for enrolling landowners in the programmatic agreement, how this process can run smoothly and easily, with the objective of reducing entry barriers that have prevented LOPs and CHIAs from being effective landscape management tools, possible length and duration, both for the term of the DNR safe harbor agreement and whether a minimum enrollment time would be necessary to accomplish a net conservation gain, and whether there should be a target acreage for enrollment in specific areas or an overall cap on enrollment acreage. This idea is kind of borrowed from the Oregon Department of Forestry's programmatic safe harbor agreement with the Spotted Owl. I believe they had a cap of about 50,000 acres that they anticipated would be enrolled overall. And completing the safe harbor agreement is a priority identified in DNR's strategic plan, and we continue to evaluate ways to bring more staff and analytical resources to bear for its timely completion. And in addition, the implementation team is forming a subgroup of technical representatives to work on finer grain issues around how to define and determine baseline habitat conditions, how to define and determine net conservation benefit above a baseline, developing management options for landowners to consider when they develop their safe harbor agreement enrollment forms, and the implementation team will continue to meet and provide direction to the technical subgroup. So finally, throughout the fall, winter, spring, NSYT members work to assist DNR in evaluating and prioritizing WASP applications for their benefit to the Northern Spotted Owl, and the acquisition was completed recently, and DNR submitted a press release on that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Lauren's always good at getting us back on time. Any questions for Lauren? Any more? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, now, get back to water typing. No, we have a motion on the table. We got to address. Out of words. Okay, Okay, we have a motion on the table that was moved and seconded. Let's go into discussion, I assume.
There will be some.
Board member Lori.
I have a question for the maker of the motion.
What were you thinking?
Since the board generally expects a TFW policy committee to, then there's a list of things, and I just wanted to make sure we're clear on it. So, first of all, it says use existing information. I'm assuming that doesn't mean exclusively if they need to take new information.
Don't look at me.
I think I made that comment before we went to lunch, is that this isn't an exclusive list.
But it's not to limit the
correct
the information there, but to take advantage of.
Yes.
And same thing with the phrase, make methods as accurate as possible. We're talking about infinitely possible. We just try to make them accurate. So it's not like the 94.
Yeah, my expectation is maybe we'll find out how accurate it can be and then deal with the results from there.
So I just wanted to clarify, we're not talking about absolutes that we can
right.
later then argue whether we've achieved those.
So I had two questions on the motion. And one is what you intend by the last bullet in terms of having the address the methods for finding those stream breakpoints address small force landings. Can you just talk a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, and those could be two different bullets. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there were two different thoughts that were put into one bullet. One is any method that gets described, if it results in starting with a mapped point, you have to have a method, a field method, to put that point on the ground. So that's one thought. The second thought is that whatever methods are proposed need to recognize there are certain needs by small force landowners that are different than large landowners.
So needs like in terms of access to experts to be able to help them with that, or just the configuration of their land ownership?
It could be all of the above.
Okay.
I'm not limiting, not trying to limit the thought there. I'm just saying I'm suggesting to policy that when they develop the permanent water type rule, that small landowners are considered. Process.
That's great. And then my second question is relating to the last statement. So I appreciate having a deadline and given the amount of work that it looks like it's going to take. That looks like a good deadline, November 2016. My question is, what happens if policy doesn't come to consensus by that date? And the reason I'm asking that question is, can we or do we have the flexibility as a board to add some language about what we would like to see happen if they can't come to consensus at that date?
So I think the motion is pretty clear, but the matrix suggests the dates as target dates. So I think that setting this date in 2016 will be a target date. The other part of the motion directs the co-chairs to come to you quarterly to talk about the progress and anything that isn't getting to consensus. You'll know well before that date whether or not we're going to meet that date, and you'll have a chance to either tell us to work faster and harder or extend the date at that time.
I agree. Board member Stanley. I guess asking you three, can you do it?
It is theoretically possible. You know, in all seriousness, I mean, to kind of go where I was going to head here on this, I think having a benchmark target date makes sense. As I indicated earlier, we've got a number of process steps where we have yet to see the recommendations from the AMPA, and we have yet to come to agreement on a timeline. You know, if that step is, you know, for the two elements I described is a month and a half, then obviously yes. If those require additional time, then indeed they would not. You know, when we deal with these sort of levels of priority frequently in policy, and you know, Type F has been earmarked as a priority for the board. We're focusing the lion's share of our TFW policy time on these issues. Frankly, the board can set whatever deadline they so choose. We'll continue to follow the adaptive management process. If that looks like, and that's the purpose of the chart, if the adaptive management process looks like it's going to push us beyond that deadline, we should know well in advance and be able to communicate that to the board, and the board can make direction as they see fit. But I think it's important to stick to the adaptive management process, and those timelines are, you know, understandably vague, but you know, you can see what the maximum theoretical potential could be once we sort of set a time frame for, you know, that first stage of our process, which is the recommendations from the AMBA. Is best guessed at how long that will take, and you can add on a couple months for a policy decision, and if you don't believe the policy is going to make a consensus decision, you can add on several months for the non-consensus process, in which case it would come back to the board for their final determination. So you can get a sense of sort of worst case scenario versus optimal scenario. But I think that deadline is a little, it's probably somewhere in between those two.
Board Member Davies.
So I just wanted to clarify, because you said it's a deadline, Chris, you may have said that's a target, but it's, in the matrix it says target, but this reads to me, the motion reads to me more like a deadline, so I guess I just wanted to.
Again, I think the important thing is to recognize, you know, the board can set a goal for us to come back to. TFW policy is going to operate under the adaptive management program. That's what our jurisdiction is. And we've got prescribed timelines within there that trigger off of something that's yet to be brought forward. So the reason I'm hedging is, you know, that could be, you know, a reasonable guess as to when we might be completed. But the fact is, you know, we're going to be running that process off of something that's yet to be determined. So I can't say with certainty here today that, oh yeah, we're likely to complete and either get agreement or disagreement by that point in time until we have a better understanding of what process we're embarking on. We should know what that looks like in September and be able to project forward. You know, I tend to like, you know, whether you call it a goal or a deadline, I like having a sort of an endpoint, a target endpoint, I think is valuable because it gives us something to measure to. But, you know, I think in the end, there's going to be you know, the potential for some variance around that. And, you know, we'll follow our process. And to the extent the board's got authority to augment that process, they certainly could. But the board manual does direct us sort of how we respond in sequence.
Okay, are we ready?
Just one more clarification, because this topic keeps coming up. So I hear Adrian speak with certainty about the interpretation of where we are in the process. And when I asked you this question earlier, you said that this is just our opinion. So this is just another point to emphasize. In approving this motion and understanding that date might slip for technical reasons, I would like to have the discussion in November about the lack of guidance in the board manual about what happens when you've already gone through dispute resolution on an issue and whether or not we're going to get caught in a in a dispute resolution loop, or whether or not the board has other options. So I just wanted to lay a marker down on that and say, you know, I hear how you are describing the process, and I think there's some uncertainty. You want to deal with that uncertainty at the November meeting.
I'm good with that.
One more process.
Sorry,
just Chris, you were involved in a trade with Stephen on ecology. Is this going to change the dynamics with co-chairs, or is there a process in place on that?
Board Member Stanley, I actually am going to, well, it's not going to address the timeline, but mm-hmm. I do want to talk about co-chairs
okay.
after we're done voting. Did you want to respond to as far as process goes?
DNR is going to be paying for years to come for this trip.
All right, are we ready to go forward, members? Okay, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? And I apologize, but I wanted to note Board Member Barra had a family emergency and had to leave after lunch. So he's absent this afternoon. Okay, the motion is passed. Thank you very much. You guys keep me on my toes. So I'd like the co-chairs for policy, CEMER, and the Cultural Resources Committee to come forward to the table, please. Please, those that are present. This is the chair is taking some this is going to be a simple request. I'd like CEMER first, then policy, and then cultural resources committee chairs to explain what processes they have in place for selecting co-chairs to address Board Member Stanley's comment.
Yes, for the record, my name is Doug Hooks. I'm a newly elected CEMER co-chair with WFPA. And also, as a side note for that, I will not be a voting member of CEMER, which does have a different process. To get the process for CEMER co-chair, there's a protocol standard manual that Chris, a former co-chair, had worked on years ago, and Nancy, former co-chair, worked on years ago, and developed for how it may be selected. So we've run into the situation the last couple of times where there hasn't been a large number of people who have expressed a lot of interest in being senior co-chair. Not that that was extremely different in the situation this year, but when there was just one person that was interested, a voting member of senior therefore put up a nomination, and then that came for a vote in front of senior. Pretty straightforward and direct. If there had been more than one person that was interested, then there would have been a committee that would have been formed. And I can go into some of these details, but how detailed would you like that?
More so about whether you have a process in place to select and rotate term limits, anything like that, associated with co-chairing a committee.
Okay, so if there had been more than one person, that would have been a committee and a process to be followed in order to make that selection. In which case, policy would have had some say-so as well as the board. But in the case where there isn't one, that's not the case. So there's also some information in the appendix that talks about some of the qualifications and desired qualifications and job descriptions and job duties. So all that is present and there is guidance for making those selections.
And I want to thank WFPA for allowing Doug to serve on CEMER as co-chair.
It took a while to work out, but we were able to do it.
Okay. So, policy co-chairs, do you have a procedure for selecting co-chairs?
No. We actually discussed this at our last policy meeting for perhaps obvious reasons. Well, I don't think there's a unified position of policy. We did identify sort of five things that we thought we should talk about related to co-chair transitions. And the first one of those, and the immediate one, is sort of creating an accurate job description of what it is a co-chair's responsibilities are, time frame commitments. You know, my personal interest in this is using it as an advocacy tool to convince people and their bosses and sometimes their bosses' bosses of the value of supporting the program in that way. So that's on the first order of business, and we've got a small subgroup that's going to be working on that. We talked about length of terms. You know, there's a range of opinions in regard to that, but suffice it to say, you know, long enough to have some time, but not too long. What that exactly entails is yet to be determined. I should caveat with this one and the following additional items I'm going to list. There is also a notion that none of these should be viewed as hard and fast. In other words, if one of these sort of ideals presented a barrier for someone to serve, that shouldn't be considered a barrier. We do not have the problem of seeking a committee to ferret out too many applicants. And if we ever do, well, that's a welcome problem. The third point, with I think myself serving as co-chair, we established a sort of, I guess, a slightly modified version of how the table was set as part of actually some other changes we made in terms of sort of administering policy, and that allows a caucus representative or a member of a caucus to serve as co-chair but not have to do the advocacy work. So Karen serves as TFW Policy's large landowner representative and has the official vote, which, you know, and as does Chris as a partner with DNR, Mark Engel, who actually sits at the table and allows the co-chairs to basically kind of run the meeting and work towards consensus. So again, that works for some folks. It's certainly a relief for us, I believe. However, not all caucuses are in a position to be able to staff two positions in that seat. So again, it's something that works. It certainly helps the co-chair be able to do their job. But you know, several members pointed out that they had been able to do both, and you can do it both. So again, an option, but not a requirement. There's also the concept of sort of, you know, everyone needing to take a turn at the wheel. Again, great idea and concept. I've seen that in many other organizations, but the reality is when your turn's up, you may not be able to. So again, I think some sort of structure of rotation makes sense in the ideal, but again, that shouldn't be a barrier for someone participating or not participating. The last issue that was raised, it's a little sort of out of the purview of policy, was that of compensation. There are some caucuses who don't have the same resources to be able to staff a person at that level, because it is an additional time commitment. And so there was talk about, you know, the use of participation grants to be able to accommodate that. Again, that's sort of out of TFW policy scope, but it was discussed at the meeting. So those are the things we're kind of batting around as a policy. But right now, it really is sort of seeking nominations from the floor, and that's requiring active recruitment. So I guess that would be our policy.
Karen, can you address?
You just said nominations. Thank you. Nominations from the floor. So are the co-chairs voted on?
No. I think so. There's not a formal action, but I think we seek consensus by. I mean, I don't think if there wasn't consensus, I think it would be a challenge.
I just use the term nomination.
Yeah. Sorry, a little too formal.
Second question. You just talked about a number of things to help the selection or the people coming forward. Are you going to write this down?
Yes.
Looking forward.
Yeah. As you were talking, I realized I did fail to address two of your other questions there. First being is that there was, it's not formally written down, but there was a desire to try and have rotation amongst the caucuses participate. And that's how the solicitation for the senior chair, co-chair came up to begin with, was looking at which caucus had had someone there in the longest amount of time. And over time, who had had people there the longest. So that was part of an informal effort that we did to begin with, as well as in the protocols and standards manual, there is a section suggesting that it be a two-year term.
Thank you. Karen, would you like to talk about the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable?
Yes, Cultural Resources Roundtable is a much more informally structured group than either policy or CMR. That's the first thing to keep in mind. And as Jeffrey said earlier today, he's been the co-chair of Cultural Resources Roundtable since 1994, so he's been there a long time. The longevity is also in the other co-chair position. Pete Heide, who was my predecessor at WFPA, had been the co-chair for probably 10 to 12 years as well. And so there's no formal system for nominating a co-chair. There's no formal system in terms of rotation of co-chairs or of length of time in terms of the actual service as a co-chair. And I don't know that the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable has ever had that discussion, because it's really been, a much more loosely organized group, open to any tribal members that would like to come, open to state agencies, landowners. Any caucus of the TFW caucuses is welcome to attend, but what we found is that landowners, tribes, and state agencies are generally the ones that are in attendance for those meetings. So in terms of actually getting a new co-chair, the way that I was recruited was basically Pete suggested this position to me and suggested that it's a very important position for landowners to be involved with the tribes on cultural resources. The decision, the discussion of these tribal landowner meetings is really very focused on that interaction. And so my, at that point in time, new boss, Mark Doman, thought that it was a good idea for me to pursue that, and went to the Cultural Resources Roundtable meeting my first month or two, and we had a discussion. And I had to explain why I thought that I should be a co-chair, why I wanted to be a co-chair, why it was an important element for the landowners to continue to be in that co-chair position. And they basically accepted my co-chairness. And I know that sounds, interesting, especially in terms of normal bureaucracies, but that's essentially what happened. And I don't think that there was a lot of interest from other folks to be the co-chair, particularly from the agencies. But it was really a question of sitting down and talking about it as a group. And the group that affirmed my co-chairship was smaller than the list that I showed you earlier today in terms of our annual report. So our group has grown a little bit again, but that was essentially the way that I was selected to be co-chair.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Karen? Okay, I have a proposed, another suggested motion. This one's shorter, though. Would anybody like to take the initiative to move this? Member Davies.
I move the Forest Practices Board request each of the TFW committees that do not